Welcome to The Loins of History, a podcast dedicated to connecting the past to the present and improving historical and political illiteracy. I'm your host, Colin, and I'm joined by my co-host, Jay. This week, we have an exciting new mini-series on the fall of the French Third Republic as part of our larger series on the fall of empires. Jay, I'm really excited to hear a little bit about the French Third Republic and its collapse. It's a piece of history that I think is often overlooked, but it's very exciting, and it had a lot of profound impacts on the decades to come, i.e. World War II. So can you, I'll turn it over to you to get started on it.
Yeah, for sure. Real quick, before we go into the fall of the Third Republic, just wanted to give a few shout outs. We get a lot of comments on YouTube. So for our YouTube listeners out there, thank you. So shout out to Major Tom Wakeman. He liked a couple of our Antebellum South episodes. Anthony Kelly gave us a great book recommendation. The book is called The Shattered Horse, which is a historical fiction about the Bronze Age collapse, which was our last three episodes. So if you're interested in like ancient Egypt and the Hittites and all that's the Sea Peoples and all that stuff, like Anthony Kelly is, you can check out those episodes. We got a user handle, a Vita Verde. He or she also liked our first Bronze Age episodes. And lastly, a dude named Mike. Don't have your last name, Mike, but thank you for your really helpful comments on our first Bronze Age episode. So just a reminder to everyone, if you give us a like, or what we're going to start doing in the future is if you subscribe to us on YouTube, because YouTube actually tells us the list of names of who our subscribers are, we'll give you a shout out on a future episode. So to our many subscribers on YouTube currently, thank you for doing that. Hope you're continuing to enjoy this episode. Feel free to comment, tell us what you want to cover next, and we'll give you a shout out on the episode. Okay, with that, we can now begin with the fall of the French Third Republic. So kind of put this one in context in our Fall of Empires series. We are looking at the themes and the threads for why do civilizations collapse? Why do empires, why do societies, great peoples, not so great peoples, what is it that causes a fundamental change in their society? And what lessons can we learn from that and apply those to today? Colin and I are both Americans. You know, we obviously are primarily concerned with the United States, but also try to apply a lot of our lessons learned to the West writ large. We have quite a few Canadian and UK listeners, so we try to keep it to the English-speaking world in the West writ large. So now, after talking about the Han Empire and Rome and the Byzantine Empire and the Antebellum South and the Bronze Age, we are now at the fall of the French Third Republic. For those of you who are interested in that, the French Third Republic spanned from 1871, after the Prussians beat France in the Franco-Prussian War of 1871, and that led to the creation of a Third Republic. And that Republic fundamentally collapsed wholly and completely, and we'll learn why, in 1940, also at the hands of the Germans. And I think this is a really interesting topic and why I picked it, because when you look at European history all the way from the Middle Ages to honestly 1940, France was kind of seen as the dominant power in continental Europe. You know, no united Germany. Go ahead, Colin.
Why is that? You know, now there's a running gag about the French being soft and surrendering really from World War II. But
right.
gave them it was that this. Bad. What's that? Yeah, it was pretty bad.
Because it was that bad.
But prior to that, what gave them this, I guess, the status of being the top power, top military power in Europe?
So, you know, power is relative, right? And The reason why I specifically said continental Europe is because over that same time period, you know, there were various entities, you know, and I'm really talking about a roughly 1,000-year time period. There were other entities like Spain and the Habsburg Empire. You know, you had Austria-Hungary was a huge competitor at one point in time. The Holy Roman Empire is an interesting beast because while in some sense, like it was a single political entity, it was so decentralized that it never really could organize and It couldn't really marshal all of its resources together to combat France in the same way that like, and we'll get to this later, but you know, Louis XIV in the 1700s just basically wrecked everyone on continental Europe. The Brits couldn't really, you know, Great Britain couldn't really do much. They had a strong navy. They prevented France from going too far outside of continental Europe. But on Europe, like there was no united Germany, like we'll get into here in a little bit. There was no united Italy to kind of cause it some issues there. The Ottomans, which were a major Mediterranean threat over that same time period, the French and the Ottomans were actually friendly to one another for quite some time. The French and the Ottomans, go ahead.
Didn't they have a common enemy in Europe?
The Spanish. Who are you
thinking?
Well,
the Austro-Hungarian. I was going to say the Austro-Hungarians.
Yeah,
I think
the Habsburgs. That's probably
The French kind of saw them as a counter to their enemy to the east, and the Ottomans obviously saw the French as a enemy to their enemy to the west of them. So it was kind of a détente, if you will.
Right. Yeah, France didn't start, you know, ganging up on the Ottomans until, you know, the sick man of Europe, when the French learned like, oh, we can kind of do whatever we want in North Africa and the Ottomans aren't going to do any, you know, Muslim North Africa. Ottomans aren't going to do anything. And of course, World War One, you know, they took Lebanon and Syria and part of modern day Turkey into a colony, just like the Brits took Palestine, Israel, Jordan, Egypt, etc. So, you know, you have France. They were the dominant power for so long. And then essentially, over a period of several decades and culminating really in like World War One was kind of like a big shock. And then World War Two, you had a united Germany that basically eclipsed France, you know, on the continent. I'm not discussing Great Britain per se right now, because Great Britain was almost in a league of its own in a sense. And, like continental Europe, the mighty fell quite far in 1940. So yeah, that's kind of like the broad overview that I wanted to get to and what we're talking about in this entire series. And at least in this first episode, if not the first couple episodes, we're gonna talk about some big themes, and we're gonna talk about some like political realities. Like we'll talk through the factions, we'll talk through the economy, we'll talk through like society in terms of how it thought. And we're going to try to get as far as we can from 1871 at the creation up until 1936. And starting in 1936, it'll definitely be in a future episode. We'll see how far we get in this one, if it's in the next one or not. Starting in 1936, that's when we can really like narrow down, and episodes will be on, you know, a period of weeks, if not months, not the, you know, roughly 60-year time period that we're going to talk about today and maybe in future episodes. So, okay, next step, just to kind of set the stage where we talk about the creation of the Third Republic in 1871. Is it's really important in the same way that in our Antebellum South episode, I wanted to kind of like set the emotional tone. In this one, I really want, like, emotionally speaking, our frames of minds or frames of hearts to really be in like, what the heck happened in 1940? And there's a phenomenal book written by a guy named Marc Bloch, who is a Frenchman who lived during this time, and he was actually murdered by the Nazis in 1944. But he wrote a book, I think in 42 or 43, called Strange Defeat. And he, it's a phenomenal, like, kind of memoir of his perspective on just the feel of France in 1940 and how it's just like, what the heck happened? Because from the French perspective, you know, to your point, Colin, earlier, you know, we kind of look now, we particularly Americans look on the French as like weak, especially militarily speaking. But the reality was, is that in 1940, nobody thought that. Nobody viewed France beat Germany in World War I. So nobody thought that France was in the period of 6 weeks was just going to roll over and collapse. Go ahead.
I would actually say that not only were they one of the main reasons they defeated Germany, but they made a heroic stand outside of Paris about 60 miles. And
yeah,
like people kind of, everybody's heard about the Blitzkrieg and, you know, but before there was the Blitzkrieg, there was the Schlieffen Plan in World War I, where the Germans marched through, obviously through Belgium and north, kind of in a similar striking motion, but speed of their attack was caught everybody off guard, including the French, and they were still able to stop this seemingly unstoppable army outside of Paris by about 60 miles. That really did save the war, and the fact that they were able to hang on.
Yeah, the miracle on the Marne is what that's what that event's kind of colloquially known as. And it's wild. I wasn't going to get in these details, but it's just like, it's good that you're bringing it up. Like, and it's honestly a good illustration of just the difference in the French spirit between 1914 to 1940. When I think it was Kluck von Kluck was the army group, German army group commander that, like, he was supposed to go to the north of Paris, but he was trying to cut off the army. So he actually went to like the east of Paris. And that's when I forget the French commander's name was like, oh, shoot, we actually have a chance to flank this guy. And they took like hundreds of taxi cabs because the French military was not motorized at all. It was barely motorized in 1940. And they were literally taking soldiers from Paris in the midst of this, you know, overwhelming tide. This guy was like, oh, we're going to flank him. And they got in taxi cars, like civilian taxi cab drivers were like taking 2, 3, 4 soldiers, getting in there and just driving to go flank a German army group. And it worked. It's called The Miracle on the Marne. It's one of the wildest things. Another book recommendation is Barbara Tuchman's The Guns of August. Not only is it top 3 books on World War I ever, it's probably top 5 military history books of all time. It is so good. Guns of August. And she goes into detail, and it's a fantastic book. But yeah, Miracle on the Marne. Okay. Yeah, that kind of stuff did not happen in 1940. It sounds like hyperbole, but it's true. When the Third Republic collapsed in 1940, like, it didn't go out swinging. Like, it went out with a whimper, and it went out with everyone kind of expecting it to collapse. And we're going to get into the reasons why. One quote here by Marc Bloch to kind of get us started. He says, whatever form the final triumph may take, it will be many years before the stain of 1940 can be effaced. It was the most terrible collapse in the long story of our national life. He wrote that in 1944, shortly before he was murdered. He was a part of the French resistance, and the Gestapo caught up with him. So with that, let's talk about how the French Third Republic came to be and why, how that can help us understand what the Third Republic was. Okay. So like we mentioned before, 1870, 1871, you had a united Prussia / North German Confederation. They, with the help of southern German states like Württemberg and Bavaria, they schwacked the French at the Battle of Sedan. And Bismarck went in, and they walked and proclaimed a united Germany in Versailles. Like, there's an awesome painting. It's probably worth finding. Maybe that'd make great episode art, by the way. There's a great painting of, like, you've got all these Prussians and they're standing in Versailles and they're proclaiming a united Germany, like, super insulting. And it completely, the monarchy was overthrown. No one in France wanted a monarchy, wanted that particular monarch. He was deposed. And so in 1871, the Chamber of Deputy, or sorry, the National Assembly. So if you know anything about French French history, the closest thing they had to a parliament for a long time is called the National Assembly. And the National Assembly played a large role in the Estates General, in the French Revolution, and all that stuff. So the National Assembly gets together. They say, hey, we need to write a new constitution. What kind of government do we want to have? And interestingly, the Third Republic was created almost as a fluke, because the vast majority of not just the representatives in the National Assembly, but just like the average French person, was very conservative and they wanted a monarchy. So the question is, like, how did all these people who band together, who wanted to retain the monarchy, how did they create a republic? How did they create a president and a, you know, a legislature and those kinds of things? And the reason why, and this is key to understanding, key to understanding why, honestly, like, the shaky foundation that the Third Republic was created on, the reason why that all these people who wanted a monarchy ended up making a republic is because they couldn't agree on who the monarch should be. There were two main candidates. There was a dude named Louis-Philippe, who was the Orléanist. My French pronunciation is terrible. Orléanist candidate. And then there was a Bourbon candidate, a guy named the Comte de Chambord. There were a few people that wanted to put a Bonaparte back on the throne, but there wasn't too much support for that. So everyone wanted a monarch, but they couldn't agree on which one it should be. And to kind of even illustrate another factor on why a lot of the conservatives couldn't get their act together was, and the Bourbon candidate, the de Chambord, there's some enlightening quotes of his here. Essentially, one of the disagreements that people couldn't get behind is, okay, we're going to have a monarchy, but we want to keep the French tricolor. We want to keep the red, white, and blue, because they still saw the revolution, even though it overthrew the monarchy. They saw the revolution as a good thing. And a lot of the advancements in individual liberties and those kinds of things, they saw it as good. They didn't want to go back to this feudalistic, like, we have the bourgeoisie, we've got poor people, that kind of thing, proletariat. But they wanted a monarch, if that makes any sense. So they told Chambord, they're like, bro, we'll make you the monarch. We just got to keep the tricolor as the flag. And his response was, I do not wish to become the legitimate king of the revolution. I.e., he's like, those two things are, that's an oxymoron. There is no king of the revolution. The revolution overthrew the king. If you want to continue the revolution, you don't want a king. If you want a king, we have to repudiate the revolution. And he wanted to bring back the traditional white background with the plethora of gold fleur-de-lis, which was the Bourbon sign. And when people came to him, they're like, hey, man, you need to compromise. He responded with, I have neither sacrifices nor conditions to accept. And he's like, I'm not going to compromise.
What a great rebuttal. Just fantastic.
Great, great rebuttal if you don't want to be the king. Like, literally, this entire like group of people were like, bro, be our king, but you got to have the tricolor flag. And he's like, no, do it. And I'm the legitimate king and I'm not going to back down, blah, blah, blah. I just think that this is, that fact is so not just indicative of what we're going to see over and over again, but again, like immediately tying in some lessons learned here is like countries begin to fracture when sides refuse to compromise. And almost universally, the thought on why you can't compromise is for ideological reasons, not pragmatic. It is, you know, ideologues kind of spit on the pragmatists and say, like, you're being inconsistent. You're not a real Republican. You're not a real Democrat. You're not a real liberal. You're not a real conservative, blah, 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 blah. I have to be consistent. And while I think there's like some value to that, it's like, okay, keep your consistency while the country falls apart. I think if we completely throw away the pragmatism, and in this example, if we completely throw away just the compromise and the reality that we got to get things done, bad things happen after that.
It's very interesting to see that you do want somebody who has conviction, which he obviously was, but how many decades before France, I mean, the French Third Republic collapsed, maybe not because of his actions, but rather than being someone who could help the country, he in principle took a stand and decided not to do anything, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a commentary on politics, really, more than history, but you know.
No, that's a great point because, you know, and as we'll see, one of the main reasons why, you know, if we were going to do a key takeaway, this would definitely be one of them. One of the reasons why the Third Republic got absolutely obliterated in 1940 was because there were not enough people who wanted it to survive. I feel like that's related to a key takeaway in maybe our history of Rome, or was it the Byzantine Empire one, where it's like when there's nobody out there like fighting for this institution of government to exist, it's like the first threat that comes to it, everyone's going to be like, okay, see ya.
Kind of. It was kind of similar to like the Roman loss of virtue. They just sort of, I don't want to say stop caring. Nobody wants to get invaded. But I mean, doing the minutia and the grinding of upholding your government, like in modern terms, think of it like, hey, you've got to go vote. Hey, you do actually need to be involved in jury duty and things like that, things that we take for granted. You actually do have to be involved in those. Otherwise, people do stop caring. And then the few that don't stop caring are going to assume power, or you're just going to get stuck with the government that you deserve, which is people that you don't want and are not capable of governing you. In Rome's case, it was, they stopped caring about what made them Romans. In France's case, it kind of the same thing happened.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely a theme. I think once we finally do our, you know, episode or a couple episodes on like tying together the big picture from all of this stuff, is if not enough people are supportive of the institution's going to collapse. So, you know, kind of going back to this bourbon dude, it's like, okay, you want to not compromise on principle. Okay, cool. You have your conviction, but you do realize we're going to get obliterated by the Germans twice. Like, do you want that? And if the answer to that question is no, then take the flag, man. Like, I don't know. I struggle to see that being a wise decision by any stretch of the imagination. Anyway. Okay. So because in the National Assembly, nobody could agree. There was no compromise. And it was kind of based on a fluke. I won't go into too much detail, but basically like one small insignificant memorandum, because they did want a constitution. one's insignificant memorandum or note on this thing, it kind of snowballed into, it's like, okay, well, I guess we're going to have a republic again. And hence the created the Third Republic. And it was from the get-go not supported by the vast majority of people. And that's actually a really good segue to kind of talk about our next section here. And I wanted to give a breakdown of the key political factions and stakeholders, not just at this time, but over the course of this 60 to 70 year period. Because honestly, there's a lot of overlap in today, or there's like some corollaries. You know, it's not for sure. You know, we don't want to say it's a one for one, but it's kind of helpful to think about, like, okay, here were the stakeholders then, here's the stakeholders now in our world. So the first one we're going to talk about are the conservatives. In 1870, the conservatives were almost exclusively monarchists. But as time went on, the conservatives were less monarchist. They became more just like nationalists. And then in the 1920s, when Mussolini took over, a lot of them became fascists. Now, it's important to remember that fascism is not the exact same thing as Nazis. Although there's a lot of overlap there, it's not quite the same thing. Nazi is a particular political party in Germany who they were fascist. But in this, you know, you can't call a Democrat in one country the exact same thing as a Democrat in another country. Like, there's nuances. Anyway, the conservatives in France, a lot of them became fascist, and we'll talk about more of them later. But in the early part, though, a lot of them were monarchists. The reason why they were monarchists is because this group, the conservatives, the right wing of France, they wanted some form of authoritarianism. And we, you know, at first, you know, if you're an American listening to this, you might look at that and go, like, authoritarianism is bad. I think Hitler, I think Mao, I think Stalin, like, bad. And in a sense, you'd be right, right? Like, we have a you know, the American view of government, at least the way that our founding fathers intended it, is that there would be a separation of powers. The federal government would not be the primary authority in any given American citizen's life. It would honestly be the state and the local governments. The federal government, we originally intended to have a fairly weak federal government, but one of the things, especially coming, you know, if you're French and you've had a long history of monarchy, the reason why they wanted an authoritarian system was because they fundamentally saw the most prosperous times in France as being when they had one strong leader in charge of the entire country. The two best examples are Louis XIV and Napoleon. Go ahead, Colin.
That's kind of interesting if you overlay that today. I mean, that has a lot of political implications today. It's kind of like, well, they're not perfect. There's a lot of things I don't like, but they give us the best shot of being what we once were.
Right.
No comment.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And it's kind of interesting to think about this today, because I would argue that Americans writ large, regardless of your political party, want a strong leader. To be honest, I think, you know, the obvious guy now is Donald Trump. Like, people want someone like on the right, want someone like Donald Trump in office. But honestly, on the left, I think there's an argument to be made that, like, Barack Obama was the Democrat version of the strong leader. Obviously, he's very different from Donald Trump. Obviously, like, there's lots of differences there. But people like worship the ground that Obama walked on to extremely cringy levels, particularly in the media.
it's high levels of charisma that they have, because
right.
He was kind of a strong man, if you think about it. I mean, we did bomb a lot of people. So it's not like he was this soft-spoken kind of guy that was very peaceable. The point is, he was extremely charismatic and he had a strong presence around him. He carried himself with a strong presence, as did Donald Trump. And if you kind of align more politically with one or the other, you're going to favor that guy over the other one. That's why Joe Biden doesn't have any popularity. It's because he's not charismatic.
That's right. I Yeah, I agree with that 100%. My point is, even like, I don't think American Democrats could, in good conscience today, claim, well, it's just the Republicans that want a strong leader and they're the authoritarians because they want Trump. We don't have a candidate. It's like Obama was literally the guy right before Trump. And, you know, there were tons of people that worshiped the ground that he walked on. Like, I think all Americans just want a strong leader because we've had good, strong leaders in our history. Like, we all, regardless of political background, look back on the George Washingtons, the FDRs, you know, JFK to a certain extent, Abraham Lincoln as like the strong leaders that brought us through times of crisis and our country's better off. In France, it was the exact same way. Now, but unlike today in the United States, back then in France, not everyone wanted a strong leader. It was primarily the folks on the right. As a matter of fact, and as we see going down the road, one of the weaknesses of the French Third Republic was that the president, they intentionally kept super weak, and they would intentionally appoint people. So the president was not directly elected by popular vote. They were appointed by a chamber of deputies. So real quick, the legislature that the Third Republic created, there wasn't a House and a Senate. They had a Senate and a chamber of deputies. So that, you know, you can kind of think of the higher and lower houses in that regard. But the Chamber of Deputies, they're the ones that appointed the president. Chamber of Deputies were elected similarly to kind of how British Parliament elects MPs. There were representatives from the various communes in France. So the left, the middle, the moderates, and the left-wing guys and girls, even though girls didn't vote at this time, they didn't want a strong leader. That was a pretty exclusive characteristic of folks on the right. A good example, before I move on to another group here, is there was a guy named Boulanger, who was like a fairly low military ranking guy. Like, he was an officer, but he wasn't like a general or a field marshal or nothing. He may have been a colonel. And he was like super populist, gave like very charismatic, to your point, Colin, gave great speeches and all about the little man. You know, this is an aspect of the French Revolution. And Marxism and communism is very much gaining ground in the 1800s and in the 1900s. So it's like, you got to appeal to the masses. This dude was great at it. This dude ends up running for office. He, as a conservative, even won in Paris, which Paris is like very far left, even back then. And he even got the majority vote in Paris. And there were a lot of people who wanted him. He had supporters from across the political spectrum. It was really weird. And they were telling him, like, bro, go lead a coup, go kick the president. Like, you've got the vote. Everyone loves you. Go kick the president out of office. Go mark to the palace. And he goes, nah, I'm going to go home. I'm going to go see my mistress.
It's very French of him.
Very French of him. Oh, and the Brit media had a field day with it. There was one guy in a newspaper saying that Boulangerism was a farce, but it was a force. Kind of talking about how, like, he almost got it. Like, he could have had a coup, but he ended up being the wrong guy. He didn't want to, like, he talked a big talk, but he didn't really want to back it up with a lot of actions. So he's an example of kind of like the strong leader that France wanted, but it never really got. Oh, by the way, I totally should have said this at the beginning of the episode, but my source, an overwhelming book recommendation for this entire series, is William Scherer's The Collapse of the Third Republic. It is a phenomenal book. And Scherer was an American journalist. He's more well known for his book, The Fall of the Third Reich. Or sorry, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, because he was an American press correspondent in Berlin during, you know, the 1930s and World War II. But before that, he was a correspondent in Paris. So after he wrote that book, he wrote this book, The Collapse of the Third Republic, An Inquiry into the Fall of France in 1940. William Scherr, phenomenal book. That's my source for all this stuff. I should have said that up front. Okay. Moving on to, the conservatives mainly consisted of the industrialists, which were not very many, especially relative to Great Britain. France was significantly less industrialized than both Germany and Great Britain at this time. They still very much had a strong agricultural sector relative to their industrial manufacturing sector. So you had the industrialists, you had most of the military, although there were a few notable exceptions that we'll talk about later, and you had the Catholic Church. So the Catholic Church, post-Napoleon, pre-1870, was still a very strong political component in France. Later on, and I'll say this now because I wasn't planning on talking about it in the future, but later on, the Third Republic actually intentionally tried to suppress the church, and they just made more enemies for themselves, because what that did was all the conservatives who didn't like the Third Republic, they wanted a monarchy. When they saw the Third Republic and the socialists that I'll get into here in a minute, kind of going after the church, that confirmed all their worst fears. These are a bunch of atheists. These people are crazy. So on and so forth. They want us to be communist and kind of thing. So the Catholic Church was kind of a decreasing influence up until 1940. All right. That brings us, so that's kind of the right, and later fascists became the far right, but that's the right in general. Now we're going to talk about the left, the far left end of the spectrum, and then we'll talk about the moderates and some others. But on the far left end of the spectrum, you had the socialists / the communists, which if we won't go into too much detail here, but there's some great research out there. I actually forget the guy's name. There's a great video on YouTube, does an excellent job kind of showing the difference between socialism and communism. Obviously, there's overlap, but here in France, they were not the same thing. The communists were the absolute far left. The socialists were a little bit more moderate. And we'll talk about the radical socialists, which interestingly enough, the radical socialists were more moderate than the socialists. I'll say that again because that's really confusing to Americans.
I was about to say, I had to do a double take on that.
Right. So on the far left, you have the communists. A little bit more moderate, you have socialists. And then still on the left, but very moderate, is the radical socialists. We'll talk about them here in a second. So the main difference between the socialists and the communists was the communists wanted proletarian revolution. They wanted it completely in the same way that the monarchists were like, get rid of the Third Republic, we want a monarchy. The communists were like, get rid of the Third Republic, we want either some version of anarchy, we want some version of a Soviet. And they would use the word Soviet because they later on, you know, when Marxism-Leninism became a big thing in Russia after World War I, they were like, that's what we want. And they were talking about the French Soviet, the various kinds of political organization under a communist economic policy. That's what they wanted. Socialists, on the other hand, they were Marxists, but they weren't necessarily like Leninists later on. And they weren't necessarily advocating for proletarian revolution. So in there's a lot of nuance here, and like any good political organization, like there's somewhat of hypocrisy, but the socialists were willing, albeit quietly, to still work within the system to advocate for socialist-like reforms. I'll stop there because I want to talk more about the radical socialists and kind of what those reforms and why they were more moderate. But the key stakeholders in the socialist on the communist side were the low income earners, so poor. A lot of Parisians that was the nexus of socialism and communism in the country. So the poor lower class, Of course, you had trade unions. They still, you know, pervade, you know, organized labor was key for Marxism. And of course, the intellectuals, like the people that just kind of pontificated in the Parisian salons, culture were real big, you know, pontificating about Marxism and all that, and Engels and that kind of thing. Go ahead, Colin.
Was there a similar divide from like rural versus urban, like in China? You know, we talked about that. Like it was generally the urbanites were much more Western and capitalist, and obviously fell in line with Chiang Kai-shek. You know, yes. And the opposite was the true, you know, and then Mao favored, you know, he was the rural vote. Is that similar in France? So, I'm just thinking.
Yeah. So yes and no. So yes, like I said, the more like lower income folks, am specifically talking about urban lower income. But the reality is like France, in generally speaking, was like kind of rural. Like its population over the, you know, over the court between 1870 and 1940, France's population did not grow that much. Whereas you saw massive population increase in Great Britain and in Germany, France's population didn't increase that much. There's some interesting theories on why that happened. As a matter of fact, Scherer talks about it. And it's like, oh, because, you know, the socialists took over, women were working more, so the birth rate went down. But then there's been other research that shows like that's not actually what happened. Anyway, without going into too much detail, it's probably more helpful to think of, like, in all seriousness, is that you've got Paris as the nexus, and then you've only got like medium to like lower, smaller cities. You know, Bordeaux was an important political town. It was kind of seen as like the capital of the South-ish, which, not to go into, you know, the cultural distinctions between Northern and Southern France, but like, there are key differences there.
That was going to be my other question was, is it, you know, I don't want to get too drummed down the geopolitics of internal or, you know, the politics of France based on region, but it is kind of fascinating mm-hmm. to see how this sets up with where these different political factions lined up geographically.
Yeah. Honestly, and the last thing I'll talk about in terms of geography is the average French person was conservative. Because even in the rural countryside, education, you know, increased. As a matter of fact, because of socialist reforms, the literacy rate like shot way up because public schooling became a thing and government funded schooling became a thing. Those were socialist ideas. And whereas previously you had a lot of homeschooling, you had a lot of church schooling. And like that creates conservatism, whereas public schooling is not good for conservatism. That was true in France. That's true today. that kind of thing. So the rural, even though they were lower income earners, they were still conservative. Okay, moving on to the radical socialists here. So the radical socialists play the biggest role in the Third Republic. Because they were like an actual organized moderate party that smelled very left. The reason why I say it that way is they did consider themselves socialists. So like they had to, it might be slightly unfair to say that they paid lip service to Marx, but they did like speak of Marx positively. But it's honestly not, like, for Americans today, like, I think it's more helpful to think of the radical socialists as like classical libertarians, believe it or not, because, and this is why the word radical is in there. The radical socialists are, as a political party and as a political organization, pre-existed at this time, the communists and the socialists and the various political parties that they formed. Because they pre-existed, they were one of the first organized political organizations juxtaposed to the monarchists. And in that light, Like when you remove the hardcore communists and the people who later came who were even further to the left as the radical socialists were the left wing, and they were radical. They were radical compared to the people that wanted to go back to Louis XIV and feudalism. That was a radical idea. And this is, I almost said this earlier, but I think this is helpful for Americans to particularly understand. Like in 2024 United States, we are all a little socialist now. Like even the most conservative people in the United States, and I'm sure, hopefully I just pricked some ears there, is like we are in favor of quote unquote socialist policies that back then would have been like anathema.
Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, yep, public schools.
Public schools, a minimum wage, child labor. If you as an American are anti-child labor, you would have been considered a socialist back in the 1800s and early 1900s. Like that was a thing. The industrialists were like, individual liberty, like go, you know, if you're given to work, you got to work, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the socialists were like, this is unsafe. This is ridiculous. We need to raise the wages for the adults so that the kids can go to school. That was considered a socialist argument.
We talk about that slightly. I think we touch on that back in old episodes on the economic history of the United States. We talk a little bit about that.
Yeah.
Long
time ago. And it's important to remember like these political windows shift. Like we in the United States have all shifted to the left relative to what what our founding fathers, even if you consider yourself the most like bleeding heart Republican, conservative, MAGA, whatever, like you're probably in favor of some socialist policies compared to what was going on in France in the 1800s. Tax brackets. Sorry, that was another thing. If you're in favor of tax brackets and not of, and which honestly, like I think there are a lot of like libertarian/conservatives in American world that are not in favor of tax brackets. But honestly, if you ask the average American, like random Joe Schmo on the street, and just been like, hey, do you feel like people who make more money should be in a higher tax bracket? They'd probably be like, yeah. Now that's conjecture. Take it for what you will. That's my opinion. Obviously, I've not done and collected this data myself. But the point being is like that's a tax brackets, socialist. Like the graduated income tax or even an income tax period, socialist idea. So if you're in favor of that, you would be considered a socialist. So I say all that to explain, like, as we go throughout the series, don't get hung up on radical socialists. They were the moderate party in France. And that was a holdover from an earlier time when relative to the monarchists, they were a little bit radical.
We're radical centrists.
Right. Fast forward just to kind of last thing before we move on to fascism and its impact. The radical socialists would be the ones in power when France collapsed. And so even though I kind of talked about moderates, and I, you know, just Jay's personal opinion, and I think we would all be a little bit better off if we had more moderates around here. But one of the trade-offs and downsides of having moderates in charge is, in this example, is that like they normally are like when you need consensus in a crunch, it's actually kind of hard to get consensus. And when the moderates tried to get consensus in the second half of the 1930s and later on trying to deal with the Great Depression, epically failed. Nobody could agree. They couldn't unite. The country was divided. We'll get there. Okay. The last like major political party that's worth talking about are the fascists, because it's important to note, and I think this is really pertinent for us today, is to talk about how normal everyday conservatives morph into radical things, like to talk about like the logic, because it is appealing and it is dangerous. I guess to be fair, we can totally talk about how everyday left wing folks can go more left, because and this is what makes France such a fascinating case study, is that both sides of the political spectrum became very violent. There were murders, there were shootings, there was rioting, that kind of thing. Okay, but fascism and how the conservatives became fascists. So fascism first started when Mussolini took over Italy in 1922. Mussolini's like whole thing was like strong leader. I actually encourage our listeners, if y'all are interested, like just YouTube a Mussolini speech, and just like, is, you know, people talk about Hitler's speeches and how like he's screaming, he's yelling. He got that from Mussolini, because Mussolini, like, it's hilarious. He just like, his eyes get really big, you know, he's bald, and super animated.
If you want to see if you can't find a Mussolini video, if you want to find a true to life Mussolini reenactment, in season 2 of The Office, there is an amazing episode where Jim rewrites one of Dwight's award speeches and inserts all of this Mussolini language, and he tells him to slap his desk and get real animated. Yeah. And, you know, Dwight goes out there, blood alone moves the wheel of history, and, you know, starts doing these Mussolini quotes, and is like,
yeah.
And he would, instead of inserting like fascism or Italians, he would say, what now, sales people? Incredible. But it was funny. And the whole point was everybody in the audience just, they loved it. They basically fell asleep during Michael Scott's speech. Meanwhile, Dwight's quoting Mussolini out there and people are loving it. One of the best episodes ever. Had to put that out there if you're an Office fan.
Yeah, that is brilliant. I need to go rewatch that episode too. Yeah, so not only was Mussolini a strong leader like Dwight Schrute, he did actually make Italy great again. Like, Italy improved. The common phrase, and I even remember hearing about this in high school, talking about World War II, was the thing that they always said about Mussolini was, do you remember, Colin?
The trains will run on time.
It made the trains run on time. That's right. And it's like, everything was more efficient. This is the appeal to conservatives. He brought order. The order, the rules, trains running on time, like society improved, crime went down, all these things. And he was ruthless. So like there was a lot of appeal there. A lot of people on the political right in France looked at Mussolini and were like, that's what we need. We'll get into what looks like, especially in the 1930s. It's worth mentioning that like, the role of clubs in societies, both public and secret, played a different role back then as they did now. You know, Hitler had his brown shirts. In France, one of the major right-wing organizations that formed was called La Cagoule. And they were basically a terrorist organization. Like, they went around and, like, murdered people, like, roughed up shop owners. Anti-Semitism was definitely a thing, and we'll talk about Dreyfus probably in our next episode. But yeah, we're already getting there. The clubs, all of these political factions, particularly on the far left and far right, they formed different clubs. And honestly, there were like dozens upon dozens over this period of time. And with a combination of time and my poor French, not even going to attempt to read all the different names, but La Cagoule was a big one on the far right. Okay, I think we have enough time to talk about the newspapers, because the newspapers are very much tied to the political groups. So one cannot understate the amount of influence that the newspapers played during this time, during the whole like 60 to 70 year period of the Third Republic. The newspapers like dominated public opinion. And the implications of this are obvious. Like here in the United States, when you have a political conversation with someone, more often than not, you just hear regurgitated talking points that you hear from, whether it be from Fox News or, help me, Colin, what's some of the lesser known, like Newsmax, Truth Social?
Are you talking about right-wing ones or left-wing?
Yeah, right-wing ones. Because it's like the major cable one is Fox News, but there's a ton of
OAN, smaller, I think is OAN, one of them.
Yeah, that's a good one. There's a ton of lesser known. I feel like there's more diversity on the right-wing side because right-wing, like conservatives
they dominate radio too. That's another one that they dominate. So it's not so much, whereas the left tends to dominate actual publications like magazine, what had traditionally been a newspaper magazine, as well as cable. Mm-hmm. The right tends to dominate on like radio. So like everybody's heard Rush Limbaugh and all these other guys. So they tend to dominate in other spheres, but they still capture a huge audience.
Yeah, radio and Colin, help me. I don't know the right way to say it. Is internet blogs a right way to say it? Because I feel like OAN, remember the Drudge Report? Like a lot of these like various like internet for sites.
For every every Drudge Report or Breitbart, there's, you know, a Salon, The Nation, you know, some other publication that is. So I consider that the political Wild West. Yeah. You know, the internet is the political Wild West, really.
Yeah. So in France, the main form of media was the newspaper. And when I say the newspaper, I don't mean like the New York Times, Wall Street Journal type deal. I mean, like, think more of the National Enquirer, like smutty tabloid BSery was what the newspapers were in France. Like, super sensational, not concerned with the facts at all, but yet they were the most widely read, and there were tons of them. And they were like, unabashedly politically aligned. Like a fair and impartial media, not a thing in France at this time. The biggest on the right was L'Action Française. And they were huge. And actually, this just popped in my head. You know, even during the time of the French Revolution, various like pamphleteers and newspapers, that played a huge role in the French Revolution, so much so that like newspaper editors were being assassinated because they were, you know, by the opposite end on the political spectrum. There's that famous painting of that dude getting stabbed in his bathtub. That was during the French Revolution.
What was
he just wrote?
What was the general leaning of the newspapers? Was it pretty left wing?
No, it was both. Like you got. Actually, so in Paris, so the major ones were all out of Paris. They were local, and those were all left, for the most part, left-leaning. Now, elsewhere in rural France, you had a whole litany of smaller, conservative, rural-type stuff. But it's funny, Scher even describes in his time in the 20s in France that like, even the conservatives read the left-wing newspapers, and that's where they got all their news.
Is it probably a fair comparison between like the yellow journalism in the U.S. that was occurring kind of around this time with like Pulitzer versus Hearst, where they were just sensationalizing stories, and it was less a political, you know, like today, like CNN and Fox are supposed to be news, but it's hyper-political. Everything you see is politically driven.
They're the media arms of the Democratic National Convention and the Republican National Convention.
Exactly. Whereas was this more like, we need to sell newspapers? There's probably a political slant, but we need to sell papers. And,
So both. It was, we need to sell newspapers. And the thing that was going to sell the newspapers was being unashamedly partisan, like super political. Like they, as a matter of fact, you know, I kind of mentioned Le Cagoule and L'Action Française. They were in cahoots, like you know, L'Action Française was the media arm of these right-wing organizations. In the same way that, you know, Fox News and CNN and MSNBC are like obviously receiving talking points from political strategists within their respective parties, these newspapers were the exact same. But the reason why they were that way was not for ideological reasons. It was so that they could sell their newspapers, if that makes any sense. Like the sensationalism aspect of it was, how do we get our newspaper in the hands of the most amount of people? Insurer even talks about, like, a lot of the people read the left-wing stuff out of Paris because it was the most interesting. Hmm. It was like extremely gossipy. Like they would publicize like random cabinet member so-and-so had an affair with.
It was more like TMZ, where it was just like the paparazzi was following you, yes. And they wanted. Interesting. Yep. Okay. Interesting.
Yes. So that's what I was trying to say. It's not like the New York Times, because, you know, regardless of your opinion, the New York Times, there's a strong difference between the New York Times and the National Enquirer. Like there just is, folks. So it's like, they weren't like New York Times, but they were definitely National Enquirer, like tabloid, smutty, like just garbage media. But that's all there was at this time. Garbage by modern day American standards. So guys like Bill Maher and Rush Limbaugh, you know, to be fair, on opposite ends of the spectrum, they would have been very much at home in France at this time. Would have had tons of listeners. And there were definitely equivalents to them during this time. Before we wrap up here, the last thing I'll say about the newspapers, as kind of a lessons learned side of the things, is like, a media that is less concerned with the facts and more about just giving fodder to their listeners, or not their listeners, to that's us, giving fodder to their readers, to the, you know, the people who consume their content, like that, especially when it's so politically malicious, it has an extreme destabilizing effect on our country. Like, to me, that's one of the most obvious lessons for here in the United States.
It's cultural and spiritual rot.
Yes.
Like in the Roman times, it leads to a decline in virtue.
Yes, for sure. Help but think about like 2020, right? When you had, you know, that the most memeable CNN moment of all time.
Mostly peaceful riot.
Was the fiery but mostly peaceful riots with a reporter literally standing in front of a massive flame, like buildings on fire. And they had the audacity to put fiery but mostly peaceful. Like, come on. Like I think our listeners, and you know this, Colin, like, I try to be as fair and balanced as I possibly can. That is just the most horrible garbage. Like, you lost all credibility. It's totally memeable. Like, fiery but mostly peaceful protests. Like, I honestly believe, and I don't know what the solution is. I don't think there is a solution. I don't even know the path to a better media here in the United States. But it's just so blatantly obvious that, like, I feel like media organizations have a responsibility to the government. I think this is where, you know, we talk about the free hand of the market, like, you know, which we haven't even begun to talk about laissez-faire economics, which very much had its home in France. We literally call it laissez-faire, which is French. This, oh, don't touch it, you know, don't mess with it. I actually think some regulation is actually good, although I admit I'm not an expert in that area. I don't even know what the regulation should be. I can't talk media. You know, we've got a great podcast on freedom of speech, and I still believe all that. But like, the media organizations here in the United States have a responsibility to tell the truth, first and foremost. But secondly, like I said, I don't even know the right way to put it, but like, the destabilizing, like, when you look at 2020 and just all the crap that occurred in 2020 that culminated in January 6th, 1921, 2021. It was like, I don't know, as an American, I just shook my head and was like, you know, I thought of Isaiah 6. Lord, I'm a man of unclean lips and I live amongst a people of unclean lips. Like, that was my feeling of like that entire year, right? All of COVID, all that crap. It was just like, God dang it. And you see it through the media, not to mention social media. So I think that might be worth thinking about as we continue this series and like the destabilizing impacts on France. So, all right. So in summary here, you know, this episode was really about laying the foundation, kind of giving big picture. A lot of our episodes, we kind of walk through a chronological story. With this one, it's going to be hard because I really wanted to get the big topics out there and major themes, because as we lay this foundation and the foundation is to help us understand why France collapsed in 1940. So we talked about like, you know, the creation of the Third Republic and how it was built on pillars of sand. And then we talked about who the major political organizations were. We talked about the conservatives and the monarchists. We talked about the socialists and the communists. We talked about the moderate radical socialists and how that sounds like an oxymoron, but it's not. And we talked about fascism. And we talked about the role of the media and how it very much played a huge role, in fanning the flames of why political violence and dissension was really strong at this time in France. So our next episode, we're going to talk about the Dreyfus Affair and, you know, how the Dreyfus Affair ripped apart France. And it's also a fascinating story. I don't know if there is a movie on the Dreyfus Affair, but there totally should be a movie on the Dreyfus Affair. We're going to talk about the battle on the Place de la Concorde in February 6, 1934. We're going to talk about World War I a little bit. Not going to talk too much about what happened in World War I, but we're going to talk about how World War I impacted the military leading up to World War II. And we'll talk about the Great Depression, how it impacted France, how France's financial decisions, you know, French culture. I already talked a little bit about laissez-faire, but and that will get us up to a future episode on the remilitarization of the Rhineland and tell the story of how that happened and, you know, just the obvious just face palms that was France in 1936. So yeah, with that, hand it back over to you, Colin.
Jay, great episode. Very informative. Really setting the foundation for us to jump off in this series. For our listeners out there, just want to reiterate what Jay was saying about subscribing, giving us a like and a comment. We'll give you a shout out. Or just giving us a 5-star review and a comment on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, Podcast Addict. We'll be able to give you a shout out in the following episode or when we happen to see it. Jay and I are also on social media. We have Gmail as well at loinsofhistory@gmail.com. We've had a few fans email us in the past before, so it's always good to hear from you and make suggestions. We enjoy hearing feedback, getting comments. We really appreciate you as listeners helping us out with the algorithms to get the word out there. And then just hearing back from you is always rewarding. It's why Jay and I try and spread our love of history to all our listeners. So with that, thank you. Have a good week, and we'll talk to you next time.